Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Adam Barrett's online. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Fred. How's it going?
Oh, pretty good. I'm struggling a little bit because I know that there's some research out there for this topic I've got on in my mind about dealing with the tribal knowledge. And we were talking just briefly about it, but I'm wrestling with, I know that there's a study I've seen recently that talked about the aging workforce. The baby boomer generation is basically, in some areas, in some markets, they're not retiring or not getting out of the way, basically. In others, they're retiring. But it's within the next 5 to 10 years, there's this mass exodus from the workforce from this generation that, from our perspective, from a reliability point of view, is I hope they take MTBF with them and we don't have to deal with it anymore. It would be nice. But they also take a lot of that knowledge of experience that they've worked with different materials, different vendors, different markets, different, all these different experiences they've had over their careers. It's going to walk out the door with them when they leave. And, right. And that's just one aspect of it. One is the way we work, right? The way organizations, they don't have to build a building anymore. You can create an entire company and be completely diverse. You can have your software team is located in Russia, your firmware group is in Australia, your hardware teams in Canada, you know, and so on. So they can be really not co-located. We already do that with manufacturing. We design things in one building and the fabrication and the assembly is by a completely different company.
Yeah.
And so the ability of engineers and technicians to look over the shoulder and say, why are you struggling with that? And get experience about what the design is inhibiting some activity or function of a product. Or the sitting down at lunch and talking over what you're working on and share a frustration with a friend in a completely different department. Whereas there's a number of things that are making that occur less and less often. So I think those two factors, the aging workforce, just taking a lot of knowledge out with them, and that we don't rub elbows with our colleagues as easily informally as we used to. Means that the ability for us to identify and create knowledge as an organization, especially, you know, from my point of view, is from a reliability point of view, is much more difficult and I think is eroding to some extent in some organizations. And now you're out in Boston, you're closer to the Rust Belt than I am. Do you see that where you're sitting, or am I only in this California sense out here?
Well, I mean, what you just described, that transformation of teams being split up around the world, is I experience a lot. I mean, I have a customer right now that I've been working with for almost a year now and developing an astonishingly complex product. And the four teams that I'm effectively working with in development and trying to integrate are ones in Germany, ones in Boston, ones in Connecticut, ones in Colorado. And these are all engineers that we're coordinating to work very closely together. And that's kind of part of my role too, is creating that coordination between them and making sure things flow right. So with regard to the situations where there's, you know, where there's a lot of historical, you know, long-term experience and that disappearing, that just, I think, exasperates what's already very difficult just because of the new technology version that everybody's already, you know, switched to. And it kind of, I feel like the core point of it really is not tied to either one of those specifically. I think the core of it is that we tend to, in a lot of projects, if you look back on them, you know, and the role and what you did in them, you'll find how much casual conversation was key to getting the right information and dispersing the correct information. Our discussion today came about because you pulled up a note that from some conversation you and I had a long while back where I made some note about the comment of like, well, thank God I stopped by Sarah's desk, you know, and found out this key bit of information for a project. And I can list many times where I've been, you know, driving something significant. And it was because of a conversation, like literally around the coffee machine, that triggered, you know, me finding out about a whole little well of information that was somewhere else or something that had been done previously that I was potentially going to repeat or get farther down the road before finding out, or some information that sent me in a new direction. And, you know, we're kind of surprised and pleased when that happens. But I think rarely do we really stand back and realize how much that happens and, you know, how much has contributed to the success of programs. So when you look at it that way, you also have to stop and say, well, how many things have been unsuccessful because you didn't go to the coffee machine that day? That's much harder to measure. But that obviously has to be happening. Phil, it has to be happening. If the times you do go there, good things do happen. There's lots you're missing. So I think that, you know, a lot of times when I'm working with organizations at the level of helping with their cultural practices, I talk a lot about tribal knowledge and I talk about how important it is to identify how much information flows through tribal knowledge and to, you know, begin to be, we're almost try to look at the program as if all that information that went through tribal knowledge had not passed, because that's what that there's that potential. That's what you're risking. So really the goal should be to diminish that metric as much as possible, how much information gets passed informally. You'll never get rid, you'll never eliminate all of it, but I think it'd be great to create it as a metric and use it as a way to measure your improvement in having established practices for information being stored and transferred.
Well, I saw, I think it was a paper or a presentation one time about the informal communication networks within teams, and they had names for the different kinds of people that are within those. There's nodes and sources and people that broadcast and all kinds of different roles for an informal communication network, and they were talking about being able to map that through a series of surveys and interviews within an organization. They were getting at the idea, though, that you could control it or use it to your advantage. And it was aimed at change management. If you knew the right people, the five or six key people that could get the word out quickly that the key stakeholders are buying in and pushing a particular idea or project or initiative, all you need to do is talk to the right five people that are trusted communicators within the organization, and that they will get the word out because that's the role they play within the informal communication network. I don't buy that it's totally controllable. It's still got to be consistent and meaningful and worthwhile, all those things that go with change management. This idea, though, of the tribal knowledge and the informal networks and so on, I've seen where that just completely destroys a reliability program or completely makes it work. But you're right. It's casual conversations is a big piece of that. But I think there's plenty of information about how to map those networks, how to understand them. The hard part is that if you know that you want to improve your reliability program or you want to improve the culture in the organization concerning reliability, how do you tap into, one, the longstanding tribal knowledge with some of the key people in the organization, but then also use the informal network to communicate it effectively?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So that's taking, you know, the community, what you just described, the internal communication network, that's kind of an interesting way to formalize it, which is almost putting a process to it, right? Where you are almost documenting, you know, the where the information flows and by who. And I guess if you were truly tracking that, if somebody left the organization, you'd be able to tell who else picked up that torch for that flow of information. Mm-hmm. But that will always exist, which is the value of humans working together. But it's, you kind of would, there would be some assumption if that's information flowing, you still would assume the information was being stored somewhere. And it's kind of funny, as you said that, I just remembered a really funny example from earlier in my career where I was leading a reliability organization. And I was about to kick off this. We were trying to root cause and solve some issues. And I was about to kick off this rather substantial root cause investigation initiative going after one specific type of physics of failure. And before I was going to do it, I just kind of happened to be talking with a guy, older, crusty, been there for a zillion years, totally chilled out, waiting to retire guy. And, you know, he kind of, in a lot of ways, had been dismissed as the technology had passed him and gone on, and so much of the new stuff he didn't know about. And I was kind of just casually talking with him. And he mentioned a research thing that had been done like a decade and a half earlier that ended up being a tremendous key part that redirected the way I did, you know, what mm-hmm. I ended up doing. Mm-hmm. And I stopped to think about it, and it was almost a cartoon caricature of if you were drawing a cartoon demonstrating tribal knowledge, because his avatar for his, like, you know, you have avatars for like your email and whatever.
Right.
Was him sitting on the back of his fishing boat with his feet up, like holding a drink.
Right.
Like that was his company image that he, and whenever you went by his desk, he basically seemed like he was doing nothing. Whenever
right, he's
you
walked tying
past
flies.
Him, whenever you walked past him in a conference room and like his back was to the window, he was playing games on his phone. Mm-hmm. So, but that's the guy who saved a tremendous amount because of information he had. He redirected what we did, you know, and he almost knew that. And that's what he was. He was smart enough to realize, hey, I'm not worth getting rid of because of how much information I have and the few times a year it happens to help somebody. And, you know, they're just going to wait till I retire the same way I do and I don't have to kill myself, you know. And he really saw that and was almost open about it, right? I mean, when your image, instead of, if you look at my avatars for things, it's me in a tie smiling and whatever, looking professional. There's even lighting on my face, you know. He was like just sitting on a boat with his feet up with shorts on. And, mm-hmm. you know, even the angle was it just was so funny. So that's, you know, that's kind of thing that's interesting. You know, thank God I saw him and talked to him. So
yeah,
how do you protect from that, you know, because that obviously, with as valuable that was, that also highlights equally as valuable was equally as much risk there was in wasting time and resource. So how do you protect?
Yeah. Well, there's different schemes for lessons learned algorithms and in institutional or organizational learning, those kinds of theories that, have come and gone, and there's a few that I've found that have been pretty useful. But I think the first step was, like any of these things, is, and from a reliability point of view, when I look at an organization, it's oftentimes a cultural thing. It was people that know about materials or processes or vendors or whatever, is they don't want to write it all down. And then there's a valid argument, well, nobody's going to read it anyway. How many programs have you gotten into where the first step in the program is to review the past project, you know, review the lessons learned?
I mean,
yeah,
we all know modern day, you know, that's a joke. I mean, you basically have to look at how things like Google work, things that have tremendous success of, you know, we're in the information age, right? Which is, we figure out how to make information flow. And Google doesn't work. Google, when you start a project, doesn't make you review documents. It's when you want information, you can replicate the equivalent of bumping into somebody at the coffee machine. I can type words into Google search. Actually, I can verbally say them,
right?
And it'll bring up references. So it's information when I, you know, what I want, when I want
when
it.
I want
the
it.
Idea of making people read documents is hysterical.
Right. It's still got to get recorded, though. Things still have to get captured in some way or another and tagged and metadata and all the other happy stuff for that whole kind of process to work. But I think there's organizations that have been successful long before Google at creating a culture where information is shared and readily available, and it's not dependent on the right person being in the room. And I think the tribal knowledge risk we face is that there's too many near misses, that we're really wasting a lot of time and effort by not happening to be at the right place at the right time. And I think retirement is taking some of that knowledge away, but the dispersed organizations is effectively taking the coffee pot away.
So right. So now it's highlighted even further.
Yeah. So Google and search engines can play a role. It needs to be fed though. I think the search engines are good enough. It's now you still need filters and the capture element of it and the filtering element of it. It still play a role. But I'm just thinking is that talking about the different ways to solve the lessons learned problems, probably a separate episode. But I'm thinking.
Well, it sounds like what we just highlighted, or actually you just specifically highlighted, is the whole trick is getting the information in. Getting the information out is something that can be addressed with technology or practices, or. Mm-hmm. But the whole trick is getting the information in. That might be the real key to it.
Well, how much do you think the behavior, many organizations, I don't know how many by any means, I'm not an HR expert, is that for technology and even to some extent for management, one of the keys to advancement is that you're a sought after expert. You're the person to go to, you're the go-to person to solve a problem or turn around an issue or implement a design or bring up a factory or whatever it is. When the rest of the organization and the industry recognizes that you're the go-to person, your standing in the organization goes up. At least at HP and a couple other companies I've worked with, that was a key element to being recognized for promotion and for advancement. But that also builds a culture where I wouldn't want to share what I know unless I'm being asked in a recognized way for it.
Right. And I also, just as you were saying, I thought of something else, that there is irony in that, because as you get promoted, you become less accessible to the people who are closest to the technology. Yes, if they want to formally pursue you as the expert, but as you further you get promoted, usually you end up with more and more managerial responsibilities, more and more meetings. There does kind of start to become this, you're a little bit farther away from the people who might be, who need that information most. Mm-hmm. You're much less likely to have a casual conversation with somebody who's two levels above you. And so if that information's traveled with them, yeah, it's now the irony being that they wanted to acknowledge that you know it, they've removed you from, a little bit from being able to share it.
Well, one of the when I worked at Raychem Corporation, Bob Saldick was the CEO, and this is a billion-dollar company, and I think there were 10 divisions altogether that were – it was a pretty cool company, did really interesting material science-type stuff. And Bob Saldick would show up at our our little cafe in our factory and sit down at a random table. But right. He did it all the time. And he regularly invited himself to our staff meeting. And it wasn't that our staff meeting was anything special, but he would attend it about once a year. And he always would use the excuse of, well, I'll bring donuts.
Right, right. Well, he got it, right? He obviously understood what we're talking about.
Yeah. And one of the things...
There's no way he was going to get that information without going to the street.
That's right. One of the programs he invented, which is relevant for this tribal knowledge thing, was that he recognized that some of the problems he was hearing about in some of the divisions were solved by other divisions. And he said it was impossible to get people to walk across the street to the other building and ask them about how they did it. He called it the not invented here syndrome.
And it's defeat, right? I mean, that almost feels like defeat, right? Guys did it and you have to go and ask if you can use their solution. Right.
And he's looking at it from the point of view is, well, why do I need to resolve the same problem over and over and over again in these different divisions? And yeah, you're different businesses, you're dealing with different customers, and there are differences, but there's only so many ways you can screw in a light bulb. Come on.
Right, you know? Right.
And
but you're not going to get promoted if you go across the street and ask, right? Like right. you said previously.
So he heard, I don't know where he got the idea or where how he recognized this, but he was at our staff meeting and he talked about, well, I'm bouncing this idea around to create an award, a corporate award called Not Invented Here Award, the NIH Award. And there's $1,000 for the two people involved. What they have to be in different organizations within the company, different divisions. And one person is stealing technology or solution from the other group, which is giving it to him, allowing the theft to occur. And that's the way he phrased it. And so we heard about that and my tech and I looked at each other and went, oh, because we had just talked about it that morning, is that my tech that I work with for this extrusion process, his son went to the same preschool as another tech in another division that was facing a similar problem. We were talking about how do we figure out what they did because they don't have this problem. And now we said, well, let's wait till this program becomes formal and we'll drive over there and get their, they had an extruder screw design that we could test and it solved the problem completely.
Wait a minute. Did you guys do the exchange at the preschool playground?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's
it's a 15-foot long extruder screw. But it was.
What do you think about it? You just said that the node for transferring that information was a preschool.
Yeah. Yeah. The two kids were at the same preschool, so they ran into each other and they saw each other's badges. Right. They work at the same company. Oh, where do you work? They started talking.
God. How many conference rooms does that company have? How many team building things do they have? How many, right? And the information transferred totally randomly at a preschool.
Yeah. Well, what we saw, though, was this Not Invented Here thing is that people went out of their way to go talk to the other groups. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a personal incentive. Hey, that's an extra $1,000 for me.
Right.
You know, and we solve a problem. And so he also created a set of courses where you would put together a cadre, but it was by invitation only. And they would basically take a nominated engineer from each division and put them in this class. And you would have to get to know the people in the other divisions. And then so he did a lot of things to very structurally change the way we talk to each other. And then rewarded us.
Oh,
the NIH was great. It was a sought after award.
It worked really well to where you could really see with projects it had an effect on technology getting shared.
Oh yeah, I mean the case I was reciting there with this extruder screws that internally it was like no, the guys that designed the screws and were the ones leading the charge to solve this problem were really digging in their heels to go talk to this other group. He's like, nah, it's too different. It was classic, Not Invented Here. And we were struggling with it for months. And I was a manufacturing engineer at the time, and we're just trying to solve this problem, coordinate it. But once we just grabbed the screw, borrowed it for a day, threw it in the machine, and proved that it worked. And then we wrote it up and we got it. My technician and his buddy at the other site got the award. But it's hard to dispute the data being right in the face that this solved the problem.
Right.
Right. But we had to have a backdoor incentive to make that happen. And right. I don't know whether it long-term, the culture at that place was really cool. People were very much technology driven and it was a fun place to work. And it reminded me of when I was at Hewlett-Packard, I worked in a corporate office, tech center, essentially. And there were a number of different tech centers across the company that were when you have a tough problem, that's where you go. And somebody would call and describe the problem. And then inside the group, we could very quickly pull together a team of the appropriate experts. And then it's immediate brainstorming and setting up experiments and figuring out how to solve it. But we shared that tribal knowledge across the corporation. That was our charter, but it was a very, very big company, Hewlett-Packard. There's other ways, and I'm sure we should probably talk about some of those, but I'm also looking at, this is probably one of our longer episodes.
Yeah. It's a good topic. It's a really good topic.
So tribal knowledge happens, and I don't think we're going to get away with it. But how can you make it work better? And I think, Adam, if I can get you back here shortly, we'll probably want to record another episode on that. So we'll leave it as a teaser for our next episode.
Sounds good.
All right. So if you're listening to these, we really, really appreciate it. I think we're just over 130 episodes now, and we really enjoy hearing from the listeners. We're getting comments and questions every now and then, and we'd like to hear from you. So, you know, give us a, go over to reliability.fm, leave us a comment or leave a question or a topic you'd like to hear about, and to a large extent, join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. So again, that's reliability.fm. And you can find, speaking of reliability and the other shows on the network, where you can leave comments and suggestions. So with that, Adam, I think we'll wrap up this one.
Sounds good, Fred. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.